Welcome to the third episode of the Union of Egoists podcast. I'm your host here, and also editor-in-chief of unionofegoists.com, a website that is establishing a historical, biographical, and bibliographical detail of a number of individuals who have promoted a philosophy or worldview called egoism. Now, this episode brings a wonderful 45-minute biography of Max Stirner, recorded by none other than libertarian and individualist writer Jeff Riggenbach. He is a man who gets paid to read audiobooks, and he is passionate about liberty, so you are in for a treat. Now, at the beginning, I do want to digress a bit before we get into the main feature. I have personally invested quite a bit of time and money into the project, and everything is offered for free. I have placed a PayPal donate button on the site, and any money sent in will go directly to acquiring research materials, website hosting, or other costs directly associated with the Union of Egoists project. I would like to thank a few people who have donated so far. Louis P., $20. Jeff H., $20. Dustin H., $100. Dan A., $15. Larry S., $10. Jeff H., again, $10. Thomas M., $10. And Dan A., again, $5. Thank you again, and I'm glad you are finding the website a useful resource. Now, if you have paid attention to the website, you'll have noticed that a great deal of the material has been pulled from the Libertarian Microfiche project that was run by John Zub from about 1978 to around 2012. Over the course of that time, Mr. Zub committed about 500,000 pages of libertarian, anarchist, free market, and other related material to microfiche in a series he calls Peace Plans. Earlier this year, I was able to contact Mr. Zub and have so far ordered about 80 microfiche or so, but there are a total of 1,700 of them. There is so much hidden in those fiche that could be used for the Union of Egoists, and I don't believe there is a single person or library that owns even a majority of the microfiche in either the United States or Europe. It is possible that an Australian library has a set, but that does us no good. My biggest concern is that Mr. Zub dies, and immediately his life's work of creating a long-term archive of liberty-related books and magazines and ephemera disappear. I recently even found out that some material was published only in his microfiche project. Academic Edward Mornin, for example, published a book called Anarchism and Literature, Collected Essays on John Henry Mackay, via the LMP, and I have contacted Mr. Mornin about it, and I am requesting permission to reproduce once I actually get a hold of the microfiche containing his work and scan it. But either way, I'll try to do an entire episode on the Libertarian Microfiche Project at some point, and maybe even try to interview Mr. Zub about it. And that point is not now. I want to say that between my co-founder, Trevor Blake, our good friend, Dustin, and myself, we are ready to match donations dollar for dollar to go towards purchasing an entire set of Libertarian Microfiche publishing peace plans and the archival sleeves and storage boxes in order to properly keep them. We need a total of $2,000 to purchase the fiche and the archival supplies to properly store them. But with the dollar-for-dollar matching, that's only $1,000 from you and others who have found some education and entertainment from the website and want to show their appreciation. So beginning in August of 2016, all money donated to the Union of Egoists project through the PayPal link will go to just the Libertarian Microfiche Publishing Peace Plans acquisition until it and the archival materials are all together here in the Union of Egoists archive. Now, in case you're wondering, or before you asked, I have looked into the cost of bulk scanning the material professionally, and right now it's just too cost prohibitive. The one quote I have is for $21,348 for the entire project. Now, I need to do more research and make more connections to see if there's a way we can have that cost drastically reduced which may be possible if we can coordinate with some academic institution. But for now, manually scanning the items, when possible, will do. The priority and most reasonably priced step is to obtain the microfiche and then at least have the access to those 500,000 pages of material before it's lost. Now, if you happen to be in the Baltimore area and find the idea of sitting in a university library for 5 to 8 hours scanning microfiche appealing, then let me know and I'll invite you out next time I go. To begin, I have registered libertarianmicrofiche.com and resurrected the index to the peace plans from the grave of archive.org. To get an idea of the magnitude and importance of this work and the archive, spend a few minutes browsing that site. And now, without further ado, Jeff Riggenbach's biographical sketch of Max Stirner.
The man we know today as Max Stirner was born on October 25th, 1806, in Bayreuth, a venerable European town that, in our own time, is within the boundaries of what we call Germany. In Max Stirner's time, however, there was no such thing as Germany. The political unification of many, though not all, of the mostly small European countries in which German was the predominant language did not happen until 65 years after Stirner's birth, and he never lived to see it. As he saw it, he began his life as a resident and citizen of the Kingdom of Bavaria, and ended it not quite 50 years later as a resident and citizen of the nearby Kingdom of Prussia. Nor did the Bayreuth into which Stirner was born in 1806 bear much resemblance to the internationally famous tourist destination the town became nearly 70 years later, after Richard Wagner had set up shop there. In the early years of the 19th century, Bayreuth was just another sleepy Bavarian village, distinguished only by the unusually fine Gymnasium, prep school for college-bound students, that operated within its town limits. It is perhaps appropriate, then, that when Max Stirner was born in Bayreuth on October 25, 1806, he was given an ordinary and undistinguished birth name. He started out in life not as Max Stirner, but as Johann Caspar Schmidt. John Smith, we Americans would say. John K. Smith. His father, a flute maker who moonlighted as a painter of commissioned portraits of wealthy men and their families, was young, only in his late 30s, when his son was born. Yet, within a few months of Johann's birth, he was dead, a victim of internal hemorrhage caused by an unspecified injury that he may have inadvertently brought upon himself. His widow, Johann's 28-year-old mother, remained single for a time. Then, 2 years almost to the day after the death of her first husband, she married her second, a Prussian pharmacist, a man old enough to be her father. Johann spent his early childhood with his mother and stepfather in Prussia, remembering little or nothing about any life he might have led before Prussia, in another country, in another time. At the age of 12, he returned to Bavaria and Bayreuth to attend the Gymnasium, where he stayed for 8 years, living for all those years in the home of a childless couple, his father's sister, his paternal aunt, and her husband, who was also the boy's godfather. At the age of 20, he left Bayreuth one last time, traveling to Berlin to study at the university there. It was 1827 now. In a few months, Johann Caspar Schmidt would be 21 years old, and already he had begun calling himself Max Stirner. Stirner was a nickname he had picked up during his years at the Gymnasium. It is not known whether it was originally bestowed upon him in a spirit of affectionate jesting or in a spirit of mockery, even, perhaps, hatred. Die Stirne, in German, is the brow or forehead. Young Johann's brow was unusually high and thus called attention to itself. You might say calling him Stirner was a way of calling him what, in English, since around the early 1890s, we would term a highbrow. Apparently, however, young Schmidt not only took no offense at this, he grew used to the new moniker, and eventually came to prefer it to his actual surname. Of the origin of his given name, Max, nothing at all is known. What is known is that it was as Max Stirner, not Johann Caspar Schmidt, that he arrived at the University of Berlin in the fall of 1827. And it wasn't long before, as Stirner's biographer John Henry Mackay puts it, he signed his first published works that way. He was exclusively addressed thus in the circle of his acquaintances, and that is what he called himself. Alas, 1827 was 7 years too late for Stirner to have attended any of the lectures of Arthur Schopenhauer, where he might well have better spent his time than he did in the late 1820s, attending the lectures of Schopenhauer's great nemesis, G.W.F. Hegel. Schopenhauer considered Hegel a clumsy charlatan, and I, for one, am inclined to agree with him. Nevertheless, it was under Hegel that Max Stirner studied philosophy at the University of Berlin during the 2 years he matriculated there. And, as will become clear in a few minutes, there would seem to be a plausible case to be made that Stirner himself was no more entranced with Hegel than Schopenhauer was. He did not, however, leave the University of Berlin out of disappointment with Hegel. He moved on after 2 years to the University of Erlangen, and from there to the University of Königsberg, and from there back to the University of Berlin, where he finally completed his formal studies after 8 years of intermittent, often interrupted effort. These interruptions, which served as the proximate cause of Stirner's long tenure as an undergraduate, do not seem to have been necessitated by either lack of money or boredom with the lectures he was now and then attending. Rather, they seem to have been necessitated by what David Leopold of Oxford University, the editor of the most recent edition of Stirner's principal work, calls his mother's deteriorating mental condition. And thereby, as I am wont to say, hangs a tale. For although his mother, as Leopold puts it, was committed as insane to the University Medical School's Charity Hospital in Berlin about 9 months after Stirner finally finished up his degree, it was January of 1835 by now, and he was 28 years old. And though his mother was institutionalized for the rest of her life after that, he was able to move her into what Leopold calls a private mental hospital, and there it was that she spent her last 22 years. There seems to be no very specific record of exactly what it was that her doctors thought ailed her. Stirner's biographer, John Henry Mackay, wrote of her illness in the late 1890s that she suffered from an idée fixe. Today this sounds like a joke, I'll grant you. I had a friend some years back in San Francisco who always responded to any reminder of the fact that my wife and I would soon be moving to Houston by talking in a way that made her mental image of Texas abundantly clear. Hot, dry, dusty prairies, grazed by longhorn cattle who moved impassively among the cactus and the oil derricks. About the fifth time I explained to her that this image, if it resembled anything in the real world at all, resembled only the western part of Texas, and that East Texas, on the southwestern edge of which Houston was located, was much more like Louisiana, crisscrossed by bayous and swamps, rainy, humid, green, punctuated by the gray and black of pines and Spanish moss and various snakes. Well, my San Francisco friend said, I guess I have an idée fixe. No one at the party my friend and I were attending when she said that to me felt that she was clearly insane and should be locked up. Instead, people laughed. But in Stirner's time, more specifically in the mid-1830s, a time when psychiatry was only beginning to establish itself in the West, the term idée fixe was commonly employed by what today are usually called mental health professionals to describe what today would probably be diagnosed as obsessive-compulsive disorder. People whose physicians decided they suffered from an idée fixe back in the 1830s were not infrequently denied their legal rights as adult human beings. Stirner's mother, for example, when she was widowed the second time, when her second husband died of natural causes at the age of 76, had inherited the house they lived in together in Kulm. The town has been part of Poland since 1920 and is now known as Chelmno. But she and her son soon discovered that she would be unable to sell the house as she had planned and moved to Berlin because she had been, in effect, declared incompetent to manage her own financial affairs, and it was now up to a conservator appointed by the local government to watch over the assets of what a local judge called the idiotic widow. In light of all this, what are we to make of the following famous passage from Stirner's principal work, his 1844 book, The Ego and Its Own? "Man," Stirner wrote, "your head is haunted. You have wheels in your head. You imagine great things and depict to yourself a whole world of gods that has an existence for you, a spirit realm to which you suppose yourself to be called, an ideal that beckons to you. You have a fixed idea." Do not think that I am jesting or speaking figuratively when I regard those persons who cling to the higher and, because the vast majority belongs under this head, almost the whole world of men, as veritable fools, fools in a madhouse. What is it, then, that is called a fixed idea? An idea that has subjected the man to itself. When you recognize, with regard to such a fixed idea, that it is a folly, you shut its slave up in an asylum. And is the truth of the faith, say, which we are not to doubt, the majesty of the people, which we are not to strike at? He who does is guilty of lèse majesty, virtue, against which the censor is not to let a word pass, that morality may be kept pure. Are these not fixed ideas? Is not all the stupid chatter of most of our newspapers the babble of fools who suffer from the fixed idea of morality, legality, Christianity, and so forth, and only seem to go about free because the madhouse in which they walk takes in so broad a space? Touch the fixed idea of such a fool, and you will at once have to guard your back against the lunatic's stealthy malice. For these great lunatics are like the little so-called lunatics in this point, too, that they assail by stealth him who touches their fixed idea. They first steal his weapon, steal free speech from him, and then they fall upon him with their nails. Every day now lays bare the cowardice and vindictiveness of these maniacs, and the stupid populace hurrahs for their crazy measures. One must read the journals of this period, and must hear the Philistines talk, to get the horrible conviction that one is shut up in a house with fools. Thou shalt not call thy brother a fool, if thou dost. But I do not fear the curse, and I say my brothers are arch-fools. Whether a poor fool of the insane asylum is possessed by the fancy that he is God the Father, Emperor of Japan, the Holy Spirit, or what not, or whether a citizen in comfortable circumstances conceives that it is his mission to be a good Christian, a faithful Protestant, a loyal citizen, a virtuous man. Both these are one and the same, fixed idea. He who has never tried and dared not to be a good Christian, a faithful Protestant, a virtuous man, and the like, is possessed and prepossessed by faith, virtuousness, etc. Just as the schoolmen philosophized only inside the belief of the Church, as Pope Benedict XIV wrote fat books inside the papist superstition, without ever throwing a doubt upon this belief, as authors fill whole folios on the state without calling in question the fixed idea of the state itself, as our newspapers are crammed with politics because they are conjured into the fancy that man was created to be a zoon politikon, so also subjects vegetate in subjection, virtuous people in virtue, liberals in humanity, without ever putting to these fixed ideas of theirs the searching knife of criticism. Undislodgeable, like a madman's delusion, those thoughts stand on a firm footing, and he who doubts them lays hands on the sacred. Yes, the fixed idea, that is the truly sacred. Stirner was an anarchist, an atheist, and a scoffer at those who took moral principles, any moral principles, at all seriously. He asked rhetorically, "Are my ideas my servants, or am I their servant?" He wrote that each must say to himself, "I am all to myself, and I do all for my sake." Away, then, with every business that is not altogether my business. You think, at least, the good cause must be my business? What good? What bad? Why, I myself am my business, and I am neither good nor bad. Neither has meaning for me. What is divine is God's business. What is human, man's. My business is neither what is divine nor what is human. It is not what is true, good, right, free, etc., but only what is mine. And it is no general business, but is unique, as I am unique. Nothing is more to me than myself. The state's behavior, he wrote, is violence, and it calls its violence law, but that of the individual, crime. I am the mortal enemy of the state, he thundered. Every state is a despotism, whether the despot be one or many, or whether, as people usually conceive to be the case in a republic, all are masters, that is, each tyrannizes over the others. When humans wish to work together to achieve common goals, Stirner insisted, what they need is not the state, but unions of egoists. For if he can use his fellow man, use their strength and assistance, then I am likely to come to an understanding and unite myself with them in order to strengthen my power by the agreement and to do more by joint force than individual force could accomplish. In this joinder I see nothing at all else than a multiplication of my strength, and only so long as it is multiplied strength do I retain it. Stirner was more than insistent on this point. He was, more or less, obsessive. The union is my own creation, he wrote, my creature, not sacred, not a spiritual power above my spirit, as little as any association of whatever sort. As I am not willing to be a slave to my maxims, but lay them bare to my constant criticism without any warrant, and admit no bail whatever for their continuance, so still less do I pledge myself to the union for my future, and swear away my soul to it, as men are said to do with the devil, and as is really the case with the state and all intellectual authority. But I am, and remain more to myself than the state, Church, God, and the like, and, consequently, also infinitely more than the Union. So, the moment he decides the Union no longer serves his personal purposes, he ends his association with it. Though, of course, he may sign up with a different union later that same day if he sees it as another opportunity to multiply his own strength. All the quotations I've just presented are taken from Der Einzige und sein Eigentum, The Ego and Its Own, by Max Stirner. This book was written in the early 1840s, when Stirner was in his mid-30s. He spent most of his days during this period teaching at a prestigious private high school for young ladies. His evenings, almost all of them, he spent socializing at Hippel's Wine Bar, where his learned, opinionated, and often somewhat rowdy companions were the journalists, authors, and young teachers like himself, who called themselves Die Freien, the free. Those who devoted themselves entirely to the great world beyond Hippel's walls, if they knew anything at all about these young intellectuals, probably knew them as the young Hegelians, or the left Hegelians. For what had brought these disputatious bohemians together in the first place was an intellectual cause. They wanted to take Hegel's idea of the dialectical process of history, whereby, as the historian Oscar J. Hammon neatly summarizes it, rational progress and historical change result from the conflict of opposing views, ending in a new synthesis, and, as it were, soup it up. As Hammon puts it, the young Hegelians were bent on accelerating the process by criticizing all that they considered irrational, outmoded, and repressive. Their first assault was directed against the foundations of Christianity. Their second, like the first, couched in traditional Hegelian terminology, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, was an impassioned defense of liberalism over monarchy. Stirner was a regular at Hippel's and listened with evident interest to all the arguments and debates that went on there, seldom offering any comment himself, more often making a remark or two sotto voce to whoever was sitting next to him on that particular evening. Not infrequently, that person sitting in the next chair or on the next stool had difficulty deciding whether Stirner's remark was meant ironically. It was at Hippel's that Stirner met and wooed Marie Dehnhardt, a pretty blonde from the provinces, as they say, a smart, fun-loving girl who had come to the big city with a small fortune of an inheritance in her pocket to seek out the company of the bohemians and renegade intellectuals who shared her advanced ideas. Marie was known to smoke cigars and dress in men's clothes. She married Stirner in his apartment one day in 1843. They must have been quite a striking couple while their brief liaison lasted. She was a blue-eyed Nordic type. He was a strawberry blonde, both atop his head and with respect to his facial hair. He did not allow his beard to grow, but did cultivate a long and luxuriant mustache, which may have joined at its ends with his sideburns. The unusually high forehead, which had given him the name Stirner in the first place, the piercing blue eyes, the ruddy complexion, the pointed nose and strong jaw, the general slightness and thinness of his body, his meticulous dress, his wire-rimmed spectacles, his small, sensitive hands. This is the whole of what little more has come down to us about his appearance. Not a single photograph of him is known to survive, assuming any were ever made. Photography was still in its infancy during the last decade of Stirner's life, the period in which he was most likely to have been photographed. The drawings of him that have survived were made by people who had known him only slightly many years before and who had but scant talent as draftsmen. Their sketches might entertain lovers of stick figures, if such there be, but in this instance at least, the heads on the stick bodies bear little resemblance to the man described just now. In the pre-Marie days, one can imagine Stirner sitting up all night after an evening at Hipples, writing at white heat, not bothering to stop to reconcile apparent contradictions in his manuscript, not stopping to make corrections or revisions, not stopping for anything, just barreling forward at top speed until it was time to freshen up and get over to the school and teach the teenage girls their literature and their history. After Marie came into the picture, one suspects he may often have given the wee hours over to other sorts of entertainment. The ego and its own, after all, is dedicated to my sweetheart, Marie Danehart. A shadow of doubt has fallen over this public face of connubial bliss, however. When, in the 1890s, John Henry Mackay was researching the only biography of Max Stirner that has ever been written, it was first published more than a century ago in 1904, he discovered to his astonishment that Marie Danehart was still living and could be contacted in London. He wrote to her in a state of excited expectation. What would she be able to reveal about the private life and personal qualities of a man she had known for only a few years, many decades before, but with whom she had been on familiar and intimate terms, living and sleeping together? To his shock and dismay, she replied with apparent indignation that she had no interest whatever in discussing Stirner, whom she had neither loved nor respected. She told Mackay further that Stirner had never had any real friends, because he was too selfish to maintain relationships with anybody else. She added that she had found him very sly. And, of course, Mackay already knew that she had left Stirner and moved to England after only 2.5 years of marriage. The influential American journalist and critic James Gibbons Huneker, in a lengthy review essay on the first English-language edition of The Ego and Its Own that ran in June 1907 in the North American Review, put things even more plainly and straightforwardly, even bluntly. Stirner, he wrote, was poor, a failure, and despised by his wife. He lived under a dull, brutal regime. The individual was naught, the state all. His book was his great revenge. It was the efflorescence of his ego. It was his romance, his dream of an ideal world, his platonic republic. Philosophy is more a matter of man's temperament than some suppose. I am unique. Never again will this aggregation of atoms stand on earth. Therefore, I must be free. I will myself free. But Stirner did not will himself irresponsible in the process. As Huneker put it, the increased self-responsibility of life in an egoist union would prevent the world from ever entering into such ideal anarchy. There is reason to quibble about Huneker's description of Stirner's home life, to be sure. In what sense, for example, was he a failure? During most of the time he was writing The Ego and Its Own, he was teaching at the private prep school for girls. And once he married Marie in the fall of 1843, still some months before he completed his manuscript, the two of them had not only his salary as a teacher, but also her substantial inheritance to live on. And all this is to say nothing of the journalism Stirner had been actively committing on the side for more than a year before he married Marie, and went on committing throughout their brief marriage. That surely brought in some additional money, howsoever meager it might have been. After he quit his teaching job in the fall of 1844, apparently because he believed that his book was going to propel him to literary fame and the attendant riches, things did go rather less well for Stirner and his wife. Her inheritance began dwindling rapidly once the couple had nothing but his journalism to fall back on. And after he lost all that was left of that inheritance by investing it, apparently with her permission, in a dairy that promptly folded, she decided enough was enough and departed for London. He remained in Berlin. Now, perhaps a year and a half after the publication of The Ego and Its Own, he could be reasonably described as a poverty-stricken failure who was despised by his wife. And things never got any better for him again. He plugged along for a few years, doing freelance editing and translation, and continuing to contribute articles to newspapers and magazines. He translated the works of Adam Smith and Jean-Baptiste Say into German. He edited a two-volume anthology of essays by other writers and called it The History of Reaction. None of this work paid very well, nor did the resulting books sell very well. Gradually, he stopped writing, or at least, he stopped publishing. Perhaps for a while, Stirner went on writing, but could no longer find anyone willing to publish what he wrote. It is useful in this connection to recall that 1848, the second year of Stirner's feeble attempt to live decently without teaching and without Marie, was also the year of revolution in Central and Western Europe. It saw uprisings and insurrections against long-established monarchies, whose strength the rebels had sorely underestimated. By early 1849, the monarchists had routed the revolutionaries and killed, locked up, or exiled most of the politicians and writers who had whipped up support for them. The revolutionaries were a loose coalition of bourgeois and working-class elements, some of them seeking liberal reforms, others seeking socialist reforms. Any writer of the time who dared to express any political opinion that didn't strike the ruling class as monarchist enough was liable to be arrested, particularly if he expressed himself as forcefully as Stirner was wont to do. Stirner was already on record in The Ego and Its Own as an implacable enemy of the state, any state. Prudence would seem to have dictated his falling silent in such circumstances, as it would doubtless have seemed prudent to any printers who might otherwise have been tempted to publish his writing. On the other hand, perhaps not. After all, a portion of the first edition had been seized in Leipzig, in the nearby German-speaking kingdom of Saxony, by agents of the state censor's office. But as David Leopold reports in his introduction to the most recent English-language edition of The Ego and Its Own, the one published by Cambridge University Press, the Saxon Minister for the Interior ordered the release of the confiscated copies on the grounds that the book was too absurd to constitute a danger to social or political order. In any case, though, the Saxon minister was the first to call Stirner's book absurd, but he was far from the last. Less than half a century later, the American anarchist Victor Yaros publicly repudiated his own brief fling with Stirner's ideas, which he called monstrously absurd and miserably nonsensical. He advised the readers of his public mea culpa to disregard his writings of the previous 2 years, which had been tainted by the metaphysical and fallacious conclusions on display in The Ego and Its Own. 80 years later, an English professor of education, he later switched over to philosophy, R.W.K. Patterson, suggested a bit more gently that perhaps we are not intended to take Stirner's philosophy seriously. For Stirner's system is riddled with paradoxes of self-reference, and the system as a whole might be said to enshrine a version of the paradox of the liar. Patterson wondered if the question of the whole system's objective truth or falsehood was a strictly senseless question. Nor is it only the paradoxical nature of Stirner's philosophy that gives rise to such suspicions as Patterson's. There's also the radically unorthodox manner in which Stirner has chosen to present his ideas. David Leopold calls the style in which Stirner wrote The Ego and Its Own highly idiosyncratic and somewhat relentless. In fact, Leopold asserts, almost every feature of his writing seems calculated to unnerve. The use of aphorism and metaphor, the neologisms, the mixture of self-consciously obscure terminology with colloquial language, the excessive italicization and hyperbole all confound the received framework in which philosophical argument is conducted. On the other hand, it has not gone unnoticed that there is very little in the way of philosophical argument in The Ego and Its Own. Leopold writes of Stirner's characteristic method of proceeding by assertion rather than argument, in order to insist on rather than demonstrate a claim. He notes also that images do as much work as arguments in Stirner's text. George Woodcock concurs. Stirner, he writes in his classic 1962 book, Anarchism, A History of Libertarian Ideas and Movements, always prefers aphorism to argument. Still, Stirner's unconventional style as a philosopher poses probably a lesser impediment to the reading enjoyment of the average curious 21st century mind than his maddening habit of devoting large sections of his eccentric masterpiece to detailed demolitions of authors and works whose names are now almost completely forgotten, authors much more obscure today than even Stirner himself. Ironically, it seems clear that Stirner believed it would be precisely his tiresome discussion and criticism of these writers that would make his book a bestseller, because, after all, the writers he was criticizing were the cutting-edge young writers of the period. They were his colleagues and drinking companions, the notorious young Hegelians of Hippel's. And his contention that these supposedly advanced and liberated young intellectuals were actually just as mesmerized by fixed ideas of their own as the Christians and monarchists they thought they had put to rout, how could such a surefire analysis fail to attract public attention, particularly when it was combined with clever mockery, parody of the most elegant and discerning kind? For The Ego and Its Own is, in part, a parody, a send-up, if you will, of both Hegel and the young Hegelians who took themselves to be rebelling against him. David Leopold cites as evidence Stirner's treatment of Ludwig Feuerbach, the leading figure of the Hegelian left. The very structure of the book would have revealed Feuerbach as the primary target of Stirner's polemic to contemporary readers. The two parts of Stirner's book, headed Man and I, are an implicit structural parody of the sections God and Man of Feuerbach's best-known work, The Essence of Christianity, 1841. And this is part of the answer to the question, is Stirner serious? The answer is, yes, he is, but only in part. Like all literary works of long-term importance, it has layers and levels. On one level, it's a great mocking of the left Hegelians, showing that their prized tripartite Hegelian analysis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, could be used to reach conclusions that stood their own fixed ideas on their heads. On another, it's a poetic statement or declaration, never an argument, about the nature of the human animal and the nature of human social relations. On yet another, it's a fantasy in which the unassuming Stirner lives his life as he would really like to, but can't. For the part of him that is serious is more an artist than a philosopher, at least as the philosopher is traditionally conceived, so that those who criticize his big book for contradicting itself and for rudely confronting its readers with unresolved and unresolvable logical conundrums are really missing the point. This is not to say, however, that there is no more to the ego and its own than what Huneker called Stirner's great revenge, the efflorescence of his ego, his romance, his dream of an ideal world. For, as John Carroll has argued, the life Stirner wrote about and the life he lived were in marked contrast. A drab and inconsequential reality was compensated for by assertive philosophy concerned with limitless human possibility. However, there is too much trenchant psychology in the ego and its own to identify its author as a daydreamer escaping from a society with whose practicalities he could not cope. In fact, according to Carroll, Stirner's work has retained its freshness and trenchancy through time, primarily because its radical political analysis is grounded in psychology. His best aphorisms bear that pungency which Nietzsche was to make his signature, an incisiveness which marks the accuracy of their probe into the sensitive tissue at the nucleus of human motivation. The locus of Stirner's interest is the individual psyche. He investigates the effects on this psyche of some of the ways men choose in their social context to pattern their behavior, and of the manner in which they then conceive of themselves. The ego and its own is a psychological philosophy of the growth of ego, of self-realization, and as such shares features with the Bildungsroman. Through its sustained, cyclically progressing monologue, meditating the vicissitudes of the unique individual, it develops an inner logic akin to that which endows the novels of character individuation with their fundamental coherence. The English historian of anarchism and biographer of anarchists, Peter Marshall, makes a very similar observation about the ego and its own without ever mentioning the word psychology. To Marshall, Stirner's eccentric masterpiece is unique in the history of philosophy. Its style is passionate, convoluted, and repetitive. Like a musical score, it introduces themes, drops them, only to develop them at a later stage. The whole adds up to a triumphant celebration of the joy of being fully oneself and in control of one's life, something Stirner himself never achieved. Yet if, in fact, the ego and its own is more like a psychological novel or a musical score than like any other work of philosophy published before the time of Friedrich Nietzsche, then perhaps it would be more appropriate to judge it by the standards suitable for judging a work of art, rather than by those suitable for judging a work of philosophy. Perhaps those who have done otherwise for the past 170 years have been, shall we say, uncomprehending. But from the beginning, incomprehension has been just about the only kind of comprehension Stirner's book has been able to attract. A few readers have understood it, true enough. I've quoted several of them in the past few minutes. I can report, however, that in my own case, it wasn't until my third reading that I felt I really comprehended it. On my first two readings, I didn't understand enough about Stirner's historical and philosophical context to bring the desired act of comprehension off. I enjoyed his individualist rhetoric and his anti-state aphorisms. I read it again because, as the English anarchist Herbert Reed once put it, the ego and its own is a book which, once read, is persistently recalled to memory. I wanted to bask in more of the delicious vitriol I recalled so clearly from my first reading. Needless to say, The Ego and Its Own was not a success in its time. It did not become a bestseller. It did not make Stirner any money. As has been seen, he eked out an increasingly meager existence by means of his journalism and his translating and editing in the years just following its publication. But by 1850, he had fallen silent, and in the few years that remained to him, David Leopold writes, he mainly expended his energies on continually moving to evade creditors, although not quickly enough to escape two brief periods in a debtor's prison. Finally, in late May 1856, he was bitten on the neck by an unidentified winged insect. The bite became infected, which in these days before antibiotics was no trivial matter. On the 25th of June, 4 months to the day before what would have been his 50th birthday, he died. He was penniless. Two of his intellectual friends from the old days at Hipples, Bruno Bauer and Ludwig Buhl, came forward to pay his burial expenses and witness his interment. Thereafter, as James Gibbons Huneker put it half a century later, Stirner was as absolutely swallowed up by the years as if he had never existed. He was rescued from obscurity in the first decade of the 20th century by John Henry Mackay, the German writer with the Scottish name, as he has been called, and Benjamin R. Tucker, who commissioned the first English translation of The Ego and Its Own, published it, and sold it in the pages of his magazine, Liberty, and in his unique bookshop in New York City. Tucker said in 1907 that, "I have been engaged for more than 30 years in the propaganda of anarchism and have achieved some things of which I am proud, but I feel that I have done nothing for the cause that compares in value with my publication of this volume." That was Benjamin R. Tucker, and this is Jeff Riggenbach.
Deep in my heart and deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. You may criticize me, try to analyze me, put me in your little pigeonhole. I'll still hold the key to the place where I am free, a world that only I control. Deep in my heart and deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. I can love you dearly, I can love you too, I can love you long and love you well. But I must have my own song, only me can sing, my own tale that only I can tell. Deep in my heart and deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. Place me in your prison, put me in your cell, lock me up and throw away the key. I will up and wander, whim and fancy free, in this big world that's inside me. Deep in my heart, deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know.
treasure chest, a world that only I can know.